This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 24th of October, these are our main stories. Leaders of Commonwealth countries are expected to defy Britain at their summit in Samoa and agree to look at ways to secure reparations from London for historical slavery. A senior member of the Italian government has been criticised for praising the country's soldiers who fought alongside the Nazis in the Second World War. More than 30,000 factory workers at Boeing have rejected a new wage offer. Also in this podcast, researchers say polar bears face a greater risk of disease than they did 30 years ago.
There's potential that pathogens could be an additional stressor for polar bears that could impact their health.
Rubbish carried by a balloon sent from North Korea has landed in and around the presidential compound in South Korea. We begin this podcast in the Pacific nation of Samoa, where dozens of political leaders have gathered for the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. A number of mostly Caribbean nations have raised the issue of securing reparations from London for historical slavery, including the Foreign Minister of the Bahamas, Frederick Mitchell.
There appears to be even a reluctance to have the conversation start. Many of the institutions in the UK have already conceded the point of apology. The British government isn't quite there. But at this time, the discussion needs to be had about the history of this and the ill effects of what happened after slavery was abolished, which continue to affect our societies today.
Britain was one of the major slave trading nations. A UK government spokesman said reparations were not on the agenda and would not be paid. Our political editor, Chris Mason, who's at the meeting in Samoa, told me what the draft communique includes.
There is a reference in it, a couple of paragraphs long, to the whole question of reparations. The argument made by some countries, in this context, disproportionately Caribbean countries that are members of the Commonwealth, around a desire to see compensation for the impacts of slavery. They feel there has been a long-standing historical injustice, that it is the duty of countries like the UK to firstly acknowledge with an apology, and then secondly to acknowledge with compensation. Now, the argument that comes from the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, we were talking to him on the 28-hour plane journey from the UK to here in the South Pacific, his argument is that the British government's position has not changed. In other words, it's the same as it was under Conservative leadership prior to the UK general election in July. There is no desire to say sorry, nor is there any desire to offer compensation. And instead, as the British government sees it, a desire to focus on forward-looking questions around, for instance, the impacts of climate change, rather than getting bogged down in a conversation about the past.
So how is this likely to play out? It's going to be embarrassing for the UK government, particularly at a time when the Commonwealth is seen as a way of projecting the UK to the world, particularly post-Brexit.
Yeah, it's an intriguing collection of countries, the Commonwealth. So you've got 50-odd countries, about 2.5 billion people in those countries, members scattered all over the place on every continent, rich and poor, big and small, where the historical underpinning of the organisation is the British Empire. A vast majority of Commonwealth members were part of that empire. Not all, because some countries have volunteered to join since then. And yes, it is an arm, if you like, or an aspect of British foreign policy, a collection of countries of which the UK is a significant player. I detect from conversations I've had that there's an irritation from some of those Caribbean countries that the UK's dismissal of their request and the tone of their dismissal has been particularly irritating. They weren't necessarily expecting some grand movement or gesture in and of this meeting. But I think it points to the fact that this issue is not going away. Those who make the argument think that its time has come, and they're determined to carry on pressing the case.
So as far as we know, the UK won't have the power to squash this communique completely?
No, it won't. It's still a conversation that's ongoing. So these things are drafted in advance by diplomats, because realistically, when leaders get together for a handful of days, they haven't got time between themselves to cobble together quite an extensive document on which they can all agree. It's quite possible, in fact easy, for leaders to raise what they choose to raise rather than being necessarily restricted by a formal agenda beyond which they can't really move. So it looks like, you know, this topic is going to feature. And of course, don't forget there's domestic politics playing into all of this, with every country very conscious about how their argument plays back home.
Chris Mason. The United Nations says 9 out of 10 people in Gaza have been displaced by the conflict there. That's 1.8 million in total. That, along with a lack of access and the continuing Israeli bombardments, has caused the United Nations to postpone an emergency polio vaccination campaign in northern Gaza. Well, as the healthcare system continues to deteriorate, treating people injured by the bombardments is becoming very difficult indeed. Dr. Nizam Mahmoud is a British surgeon who's recently returned from Gaza, and he spoke to the BBC's James Copnell about his experiences there.
The case that I remember most often now, I think, is a 7-year-old called Amma, who was living in a tent with his mother and a few other relatives, like so many other people are in the so-called green zone in southern Gaza. And a bomb was dropped. And after the blast, he described a drone coming down, which then shot him. It hovered over him, took its time, and then fired pellets into him. When he came to us, he had life-threatening injuries, with his stomach coming out of his chest. He'd injured his liver, his spleen, his bowel, and we had to operate on him. Luckily, he survived, but he was one of the lucky ones. So many other children didn't survive, and indeed, most of the casualties that we treated were women and children.
Were you treating a lot of people every day?
Yeah, I was working in Nasser Hospital, which was pretty much the last hospital in the whole of Gaza with any significant facilities, and even those facilities were very limited. We would get 1 to 2 mass casualty events every day. By comparison, if you take a major trauma centre in the UK, they might expect 1 or 2 a year.
Nasser Hospital, I think, is in Khan Yunis, more towards the south of Gaza, but we're talking a lot at the moment about northern Gaza. Have you had word from colleagues, contacts there about the situation, particularly in regards to food, but also, I suppose, the medical aspect there?
A large number of the people that I was working with in Nasser Hospital were originally from the north and still have relatives there, so I hear a little bit about the situation. I can't imagine what it must be like for the people in northern Gaza, because all the aid workers said that they'd never seen anything as bad as this in any conflict area, and that certainly applies to me. I've worked in a number of conflict zones. There is no effective medical care, really, at all. Food is being restricted. Water is not available. All in the south, we experience people living in tents, the side of the road, sometimes in the middle of the road, with no sanitation, no running water. All of that was difficult.
One question perhaps on polio. We've heard about the risks of it spreading in war zones. I believe a mass polio vaccination campaign has been halted in northern Gaza. Is that one of the perhaps more longer term concerns about what's happening in Gaza?
If there's a polio epidemic, it will obviously devastate the lives of so many children, not just in Gaza, but I think the reason that the Israeli army has allowed the vaccinations to happen is because it's concerned that it could then spread into Israel itself.
Dr. Nizam Mahmoud. The Israeli military says it struck several Hezbollah weapons production facilities on Wednesday night in southern Beirut. The ongoing bombardments are forcing more and more people to flee their homes, and the country is struggling to deal with the huge numbers displaced. Most of the bombing has been in Shia Muslim areas. As our correspondent Jonathan Head reports, this is causing tension between the displaced Shia and other communities.
Sometimes the pressure of living under non-stop bombardment just boils over. These are Lebanese Shia Muslims, uprooted by the airstrikes and now being evicted from a building where they'd sought shelter in Beirut's Hamra district. They hurl bins, boxes, anything they can, at the riot police. Lebanon is absorbing hundreds of thousands of newly displaced people, and this risks reopening old sectarian divisions.
Well, I've come to Hamra, to the place where the clash with the police happened. Lots of people just standing around looking very jumpy and nervous. And I'm outside the building where dozens of Shia families displaced by the bombing moved a few weeks ago. It was empty then. Now they've been given just 48 hours to leave. So this is a very bare entrance hall to what must have been quite a grand building, but it's very run down now and it's packed full of people. So we're just looking into one of the rooms in this building.
Yes, you want to see the room?
Yes, very small for you. How many people here?
Yeah, how many? It's nine, eight.
Eight people.
We are eight people.
But there's not much space. It's very crowded.
Yeah.
Yeah. How long have you been here? 17 days. Okay.
Marhaba.
One man, a father of five from Beirut's southern Dahia neighbourhood, says the landlady wants them out because they are Shia.
If she accept to pay rent, we already can pay rent, but she didn't accept.
She wants you to go.
She wants to go. It's not only about the building, it's something else. I think, and this is my opinion, okay? She wants to kill the Muslim here.
The Shia?
Exactly.
Sarah Al-Sharif has been helping IDPs in the northern city of Tripoli, which has been taking in large numbers of them. The street seller said he worries that some of the incomers might be affiliated with a political organization, by which he meant Hezbollah, making them a possible target of an Israeli airstrike. But he didn't want to say more. He was fearful of being overheard. Some of the shops, though, were pleased with the extra customers they were getting.
It's not been a problem. It's increase in business. Business has been good lately. Well, the displaced people are buying new clothes, new stuff. But it's also tragic what happened. It's not good.
It's not good either for the father of five, now facing an eviction order from the building he's made his home for the past 3 weeks.
What we can do? And now, today, we have 48 hours to leave it.
And where will you go?
I don't know. Maybe I will back to Dahi.
That's not safe.
If I will die like that, I will die like man. I will back to my home.
That Shia refugee was ending the report by Jonathan Head in Beirut. A senior Italian politician has praised soldiers from the country's Second World War armed forces, saying they had sacrificed their lives for freedom. Paola Chiesa represents the governing Brothers of Italy party, which has its origins in the country's wartime fascists. Our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss, reports.
This really doesn't go with the image Italy's prime minister wants to project. Giorgia Meloni has been at pains to distance herself from her party's wartime fascist roots. But that war saw Italian soldiers fight alongside Nazi Germany's army at the Battle of El Alamein in North Africa. And on the anniversary of that battle, her close colleague Paola Chiesa described it as heroic, saying the heart of the nation was there. Critics were quick to condemn her comments, one saying it was incomprehensible to argue Italy's soldiers had died for freedom.
Paul Moss. There is perhaps no more uncomfortable image of the warming Arctic than seeing a polar bear balancing on a small melting block of ice. But the changing climate means they're not only forced to spend more time in the water, but also on dry land. And new research says this is leading to the risk of diseases that they may not have encountered 30 years ago. Dr. Karen Rode is a wildlife biologist from the US Geological Survey and is the study's lead researcher.
I think our study shows that there's potential that pathogens could be an additional stressor for polar bears that could impact their health. I think the biggest concern for polar bears, including this population specifically, is loss of their sea ice habitat and continued loss of their sea ice habitat.
Our science correspondent, Victoria Gill, told us more about the research.
It's an amazing set of data that was actually gathered. It's a group from the US Geological Survey that do health checks on polar bears. So it's very intensive. They go out in the high Arctic. They're looking in the Chukchi Sea, which is between Alaska and Russia. So this is actually a really stable population in the very cold high Arctic where the effects of climate change aren't playing out quite so quickly. But they gathered this data 30 years ago doing these like health checks on sedated polar bears. And they've basically gone back and repeated it three decades later. And they've looked at 30-year-old blood samples and blood samples today and screened them for pathogens, for parasites, viruses and bacteria. And they looked at six different pathogens that are mainly associated with land-based animals, so livestock diseases and wildlife diseases. The headline finding is that they're much more common today in polar bears than they were just 30 years ago. So as the sea ice has diminished with climate change, the disease landscape is changing. So they don't know if the polar bears got sick. They can only tell from their blood whether they've encountered that pathogen. They've had it at some point. But it's showing that things are changing in the Arctic in terms of disease.
So what we're seeing is perhaps the polar bears having had these pathogens, they've survived clearly from having that pathogen. So it hasn't killed them. But the concern is that the sheer number of pathogens coming in there could have really bad impacts in the future.
Yeah, and that they're different pathogens as well. So as their lifestyle kind of changes, so there's good evidence that even in the very high Arctic, these polar bears are spending more time on land because there's longer of an ice-free or a very kind of low ice summer. So they have to come on land. And on land, they can't really hunt. They forage, but they can't get enough calories. So their diet's changing, their environment's changing. And with that, the disease landscape, how it shifts, what prey species they're eating and what they're encountering in their environment and how they could catch disease is changing too.
Interestingly, I was looking online before we came on air. The number of polar bears has actually increased since the 1960s, up from about 12,000 to 30. But that really does belie the underlying threats for polar bears.
Yeah, the main threat to polar bears is climate change and is the diminishing sea ice. The numbers are really interesting because it depends where you look in the world in terms of what is happening to the population, but certainly the future and what is playing out in the Arctic and the measurable reduction in sea ice in just recent decades is having an impact and is forecast to have an impact going forward. So we're seeing that play out in this population now.
Victoria Gill. Still to come in this podcast.
Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice.
The Hollywood journey is an Alice in Wonderland kind of journey. You go up, you go down, you go sideways. That's just the way it is.
Ahead of the opening of a major career retrospective in London, the filmmaker Tim Burton talks to us about his work. North Korea has sent another wave of balloons filled with rubbish into the South. For the first time, the balloons carried propaganda attacking the president and the first lady. Pyongyang has sent thousands of balloons since May in response to South Korean activists who fly propaganda leaflets into the North. The contents from some of these latest balloons have landed in the presidential compound in downtown Seoul. Our Seoul correspondent, Jean McKenzie, has the details.
Pyongyang has now sent dozens of waves of these balloons over to South Korea, filled with rubbish. But the contents of today's balloons were different. They carried leaflets criticising South Korea's president and his wife, the First Lady, calling him a thug and accusing her of extravagant spending. One of the balloons burst over the presidential compound in Seoul, scattering the leaflets across it. This latest launch follows claims by North Korea that the South Korean military used drones to drop leaflets over Pyongyang, which criticised Kim Jong-un and his daughter.
The plane maker Boeing has been facing problems on several fronts. On Wednesday, the company reported a multi-billion dollar quarterly loss. And then a few hours later, the people who build the planes rejected a new contract that would have ended a strike by more than 30,000 of them.
I voted no, and I'm feeling like they're continually trying to give us the bare minimum, and it's ridiculous. We all have families to feed.
I'm not really liking it so far. I mean, there's some things that got better, like the wage increase, and that's really it, honestly.
I still voted to reject the contract just because I feel like I would like a larger wage increase. I think the way they have it set up to get 12%, then 8% over the course of 4 years is... it's kind of dumb. I think we have the upper hand on Boeing, and it's good to just keep looking for something better.
I asked our business correspondent, Theo Leggett, how much of a problem this is for Boeing.
It's very serious for Boeing now. This strike has been going on for the best part of 6 weeks, and it affects 33,000 workers, mainly in the Pacific Northwest of the United States. Now, that's where Boeing has some of its most important plants, Renton, where they make the 737 MAX, and at Everett, where they make the 777. So every day that this strike goes on is costing the company a lot of money. And this was the second version of the contract to be rejected. It promised a 35% pay increase for workers over 4 years, a big ratification bonus, a one-off bonus of $7,000 if they signed up to it, and improved retirement packages. But what Boeing is fighting against here is years and years of built-up resentment among the workforce who, when Boeing's management were in a position of strength, saw their terms and conditions eroded. And now it's very different. Boeing is facing worker shortages. It's fighting battles on multiple fronts. The last thing it needs is a battle with some of its most important workers. And therefore, those workers are now in a position of strength, and they're using that strength.
And Boeing is in a political financial weakness. I mentioned those quarterly losses. What's that down to?
The losses are across the board. So the defence business has been losing quite a lot of money, around $2 billion in the last 3 months. The commercial side of the business losing $4 billion. Now, some of that is one-off charges due to specific problems with specific programmes. But what we're also looking at here is the rate at which Boeing is burning through cash. And obviously, if you're a plane maker, the way you bring cash in is by delivering planes. Boeing cannot deliver planes at the moment. It can deliver the 787 because that's made at a different plant in South Carolina, but it can't deliver its best-selling 737 MAX, or at least those deliveries are going to dry up as the completed planes move out of the factory. So it's not bringing in cash, it's burning through cash. And the only way to deal with that really is to go to your shareholders and say, give us more money, or to borrow more. And Boeing's trying to do both at the moment. But it already has $57 billion worth of debt, most of it accrued since 2019. So this is a debt-ridden company. Debt has to be serviced. That costs you money, and it's not building planes. And fundamentally, if an aircraft company isn't building planes, it's in trouble. And if Boeing's in trouble, so is a huge network of suppliers as well, because Boeing's tentacles feed out into the wider US economy, and a lot of the suppliers are now feeling the pinch as well.
Theo Leggett. Football is one of Britain's most lucrative and influential products, and it's potentially about to become a lot more regulated with new government intervention. The Football Governance Bill would change the financing and the culture of clubs. Our reporter David Lewis told me more.
Yes, football is one huge export. The game was invented here, and now the top league of English football is watched and loved by supporters in the UK and overseas. An incredible 1.87 billion people follow the English Premier League worldwide. But as it becomes bigger and bigger business, fans have felt sidelined, watching on forlorn as their clubs switch stadiums, jack up ticket prices, update long-held logos, even, and this is too much to bear for some of us football fans, changing club colours. Sacrilege. And now politicians are stepping in. Their aim is to hand more power to club fans, not just owners and shareholders. The Football Governance Bill is being presented to Parliament today. The government believes it will steady club finances too, as well as improve club equality and diversity. The regulator is also expected to have powers to distribute more money from the muscle of the Premier League to the lower tiers. And the figures are eye-watering. Global investment saw the EPL generate record revenues of almost $8 billion last year. But down the food chain, it's not all massive paydays and sold-out stadiums. Lisa Nandy is the Culture Secretary, and she outlined what practical steps this proposal will take.
The bill will enable the independent regulator to take action, to take much tougher measures, including imposing licensing conditions if clubs aren't compliant. The bill doesn't propose that fans have a veto over issues. It proposes that they must be part of the conversation. And there are different ways that different clubs choose to engage their fans. But what this makes clear is that they must do so or face consequences to put fans right back at the heart of their clubs, because fans are the biggest assets that football clubs have.
Was Lisa Nandy, the Culture Secretary. Not everyone is happy with this idea, though.
That's right. This new legislation would impact clubs in the top five tiers of the game. And the big beasts of the Premier League are concerned about excessive financial redistribution to lower league teams. Claire Sumner is Policy Chief and Social Impact Officer at the Premier League. She spoke to the BBC.
I think it goes to the core of the financial regulation, which is based on banking style, quite rigid regulation, which if it's sort of applied equally to all 116 clubs, could really damage the competitiveness of the Premier League. And it's the competitiveness of the Premier League that's so important, because that's what drives a 20-club competition. Fans get excited because they don't know who's going to win. And I think that's really, really important. And then the other element, which is, you know, an unprecedented intervention potentially into the distribution arrangements from the Premier League to the Championship, which are currently in place and actually one of the most generous settlements in football.
Well, Rick Parry, chairman of the English Football League, those are the three tiers below the Premier League, said those clubs welcome the new bill. He said, "We believe it's been framed in a way that will enable the new regulator to protect and achieve the sustainability of clubs across the entire football pyramid."
David Lewis. The Ping Pong Parkinson World Championships is an annual table tennis competition that brings together people with Parkinson's disease from around the world. Gillian Lacey-Solimar, a former BBC journalist, has just won a gold medal in the ladies' single tournament. She also co-presents the Movers and Shakers podcast about life with Parkinson's. Gillian spoke to Emma Barnett about the benefits of the sport.
Not only was I not a ping pong player, I'm not sporty at all. And the irony, of course, is that if I were able-bodied, still I'd never have won anything at all. But the very best thing about it all was the effect it had on my health. It was amazing. I mean, the only disease-modifying thing out there is exercise. And it has to be a specific sort of exercise. Exercise which combines mind and body, which means that you have to be thinking at the same time about something else, preferably, as your body is charging around. So ping pong does exactly that, because you're running around the table and at the same time you're trying to strategize, thinking, oh, if I put it at the back, are they less likely to get it? Then will they put it at my front, etc.? So you're constantly thinking. And it works wonders. It really does. I mean, one of the things that goes is parallel processing, the ability to do two things at the same time. And I've got it back. I mean, it may only be temporary, but I have got it back for now.
And did that happen while you were playing? Is that what you realised? Or it then goes into your everyday life?
Do you know, I don't know the answer to that yet, because it did happen while I was playing. But I've become completely obsessed with the game. So I've been playing an hour every day since I got back, and it's still there. So I don't know. I'll have to report back what happens when I, or if I ever stop playing.
Gillian Lacey-Solimar. He's one of the world's most acclaimed directors, known for his eccentric and surreal filmmaking. Now, Tim Burton's archives of costumes, models and drawings from films and programmes like Beetlejuice, Edward Scissorhands and Wednesday are going on display in London. Our correspondent Charlotte Gallagher went to meet him.
I can't believe I'm doing this. Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice!
The Hollywood journey is an Alice in Wonderland kind of journey. You go up, you go down, you go sideways. That's just the way it is. But I did feel lately, doing Wednesday, going to Romania and just doing it, and then doing Beetlejuice, you know, it kind of reconfirmed the fact that if people want me to do something, it's best to let me do what I, you know. There's often a case of, like, once you become a thing, that they want you, but then they don't want you.
Yeah.
And so you get into this sort of Kafka-esque sort of environment of, like, well, they want you, but they don't want you. So what I realize now, and maybe because I'm older as well, it's like, okay, I'm just going to do what I want. And if you want to do it, fine. If not, then you don't have to go on this journey with me.
Boys and girls of every age, wouldn't you like to see something strange?
I think you're quite rare among directors and writers and creators in that you're a bit similar to Roald Dahl, in that you don't patronise children, you don't patronise kids, and they're drawn to the monsters and the scary stuff.
It's exactly, I mean, I can't tell you how many films, every film I ever did, and first of all, I never said, I'm making this for children or adults, right? So, but they go, you can't, so it's too scary for kids, even like Nightmare. And you know what? It's the big, I've heard this every single time, and every single time it means nothing. It's funny, because like, little kids, Nightmare, little kids. I grew up watching monster movies, so I know some kids can handle it, some kids can't, and that's fine. You know, everybody's an individual. You don't have to force them Clockwork Orange style to sit there and watch a horror movie. You know, they'll either go for it or they won't go for it, like I did.
Can you be scary?
What do you think of this?
When you're making one of your films, or you're making a sequel to one of your films, do you just kind of have to block out what's going on the internet, what people are saying, and just make your own film?
Yeah, if you, anybody who knows me is I'm a bit technophobe. And so what I find is, that's why I don't go onto it much. If I look on the internet, I found really that I got quite depressed. It was interesting. It scared me because I started to go down a dark hole. I looked up things like buying some dinosaurs, which was good, but looking up things that I just felt like I was going down a dark path, and it didn't make me feel good. So I try to avoid it because it doesn't make me feel good.
How do you feel about artificial intelligence? Does it scare you?
Something I can't even quite fathom. I mean, yeah. All I know is from what I said, there was an AI version of characters, Disney characters designed by me, AI, right? And until it happens to you, you really don't understand it. But it was quite disturbing. Emotionally disturbing. I felt like my soul had been taken from me.
And the monsters in your films are often the ones that visually, they look scary, they're monstrous, but they're the ones that people connect with the most, and they tend to be the heroes.
When I grew up on watching these movies, I mean, it was very clear, all of them, from King Kong to Frankenstein to Creature from the Black Lagoon, all the monsters were the most emotional. You know, the humans were the ones that scared me. Mm-hmm. They were the ones, the angry villagers in Frankenstein, like the internet, these nameless faces, you know.
Tim Burton. And that is all from us for now. But before I go, it is still not too late to send in your questions about climate change for a special podcast we're recording ahead of this year's UN meeting. A lot of you have already sent in questions about the impact of wars on our climate, how companies can be held to account over the emissions cuts they've promised, how the wealthy world is helping nations most at risk of sea level rises, many, many more questions besides. Please just send us your questions in the form of a voice note with your name, where you're from, and your question. Our top climate change experts will be here to answer them. Send them to the normal address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Thanks very much. This edition was mixed by Volodymyr Muzeska, and the producer was Stephanie Tillotson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.